Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, is inflation making a comeback? But up front, President Joe Biden is making spending proposals of historic proportions on an infrastructure plan and a family safety net program. In total, the president is calling for $4 trillion in spending over much of the next decade. When the president outlined his plans before a joint session of Congress and the American people last week, most of the analysis were along party lines. Democrats love the plans, while Republicans balk at the big price tags. Although almost everyone agrees infrastructure needs to be modernized if they can agree on what infrastructure actually is. So today we're getting a nonpartisan view of the proposals. Joining us is Heather Long. She's an economics correspondent at the Washington Post. And before joining the Post, she was a senior economics reporter at CNN and a columnist and deputy editor at the Patriot News here in Harrisburg. Heather Long, always good to talk with you.
Hi, great to be back.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Bold, a liberal wish list, a huge job creator, not an infrastructure plan, just what the nation needs right now, a big tax increase. Heather, these are all descriptions of President Biden's infrastructure and American family plans. How would you describe these plans?
In some sense, a lot of those monikers are somewhat true. Look, there's no doubt this is a bold, big plan to really reshape the U.S. economy and reshape the government role in the economy. And that's both on the physical infrastructure side that many of us have been moaning about for years as we drive down the roads and bridges every day or see our airports that are not as nice as many other parts of the world. But it's also what the Biden administration likes to call the care economy. And you can debate if this is infrastructure or not, but certainly it's a little bit odd to be sitting in the United States as a young women and men and know that you don't get guaranteed parental leave when pretty much everywhere else in the world you would. So there's they're really trying, they argue they're trying to modernize the economy and really set us up for the next few decades. But obviously, there's a huge price tag to this. $4 trillion is not nothing. And they're proposing some pretty sharp tax increases to pay for it.
So the president outlined his infrastructure plan, which he called the American Jobs Plan, first, $3 trillion. And then last week, proposed in front of the scaled down joint session of Congress and to the American people, the American family plan. Can the two be separated?
Oh, yes, they can. And honestly, that's probably how it will work politically. There's hope that they can win some Republican votes on the physical infrastructure side. So that $2.3 trillion, it is true that only 5% of that goes to roads and bridges. But most people would argue that lead pipes being replaced is also infrastructure, or in the digital economy, the money that's allotted in that plan to get more and more of the country up to speed digitally and ensure that everybody in America has access to high-speed internet, that should be considered infrastructure as well. Where you might see some shaving off is, or some debate, is there's, for instance, in that package, a $300 billion that would be allotted to home health care initiatives, so various ways to help elderly care. So that's a little bit more debatable if that's sort of in the physical infrastructure bucket. But the White House is actively talking to Republicans on the Hill about that plan. And the harder push is really going to be this care economy, the second plan, which was just released last week. They anticipate, even on the Democratic side, there's a lot of focus on that Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. He's already kind of said, You know, he doesn't love a lot of the tax increases, such as the capital gains tax increase that are part of the second package. So I think you're going to get a separated plan where they'll hope to win Republican votes on the first side, and then they'll just do that, what's called that reconciliation, where they can do it with the 50 Democratic votes only. But even in that second plan, it's likely to see some pretty dramatic changes.
You have written that what the president is proposing is an experiment that has never been tried in modern U.S. economic history. You know, why did you describe it that way?
Well, we just haven't spent this much money all at once in a non-wartime capacity. So here we are in a peacetime, situation as we get out of Afghanistan. But at the same time, the economy is obviously picking up. Already, Wall Street forecasters are tripping over each other to predict how great the year 2021 and 2022 are likely to be. Numbers are coming out that we could see 10% growth this year, which is just mind-boggling. In the United States, obviously, that's, you know, sort of the economy bouncing back from a terrible, horrible year last year that so we all lived through. But you know, we're talking about the best growth since the 1984, if not earlier, to happen. So to be injecting this much money, you know, this much stimulus into an economy at a time when it's already running pretty hot, so to say, that's where this is really uncharted waters. And the White House, you're going to talk about inflation in the later half of this hour with the Gettysburg College professor. That is the number one concern. And honestly, when I talk to people in the White House, that's their concern too. They downplay it publicly. They say they think they can keep it under control. They don't think it'll spiral. This is not a repeat of the 70s. But the you know, nobody really knows if this is going to play out or not. And I keep sort of emphasizing to people, Biden can look like a genius if he gets all this done and we don't end up having inflation and we do get a lot of these different policies in place. He could also look like a terrible train wreck because we did all this and there were all these unintended consequences that weren't fully thought through. And you really just don't know which way it's going to go at this point.
And those unintended consequences, really all the things that we're talking about are so interrelated and intertwined. But, you know, one of the things I try to do when we're talking about the economy is, you know, talk about some of the basics because we're not all economists or economic scholars. So why is inflation, is it something that is of a concern right now with the economy coming back gangbusters from what everyone forecasts later this year?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of your listeners can probably relate. If anybody has gone to the Home Depot or Lowe's or other stores to try to buy lumber or other products, those are certainly jumping in price. I myself just tried to get a rental car this week, and it's, you know, by far and away the most I've paid in years for a rental car, and I'm driving one of the cheapest cars I think I've ever rented. So we know that those prices are up over 10%, if not more, year over year. A lot of people are struggling to pay for meat when they go to the grocery store because particularly some beef products, for instance, and some pork products are up 6 to 10%. Depending upon what you're buying from a year ago. So we're already starting to see inflation in certain sectors of the economy, certainly home prices right now. Even in central PA, I've heard some crazy stories from realtors about, you know, all these bidding wars and homes just going for a way over asking price. So why is this a problem? Well, in some ways it's good if you're that person who's selling the lumber or you're selling your home right now. Sure, you feel great getting that more money, but it just becomes harder and harder for certainly middle class and certainly working class families to be able to buy items, to buy goods, to buy services in a situation when inflation, when the prices keep rising and rising and rising. So that's why it's a concern. And once it's almost like a ball rolling, or I sometimes talk about it like termites. You know, it's one of those problems you don't always see right away, but by the time you see it, feel it, it's too late, and it really can devastate the economy, similar to what we saw in the 70s. And so that's why people want to make sure that we don't end up in sort of a rising price spiral.
But one of the big differences between the 70s and now is that in 1974 and 1979, when there was double-digit inflation, was OPEC. And that may not be an organization that a lot of people think about today, but the oil-producing nations, that they reduced their oil production. And you know, that was a big factor. The price of gasoline, the price of oil, drove inflation in a lot of areas. We don't have that now. So is this simple supply and demand that the government has provided stimulus money? People have money. There will be more jobs created, so there will be money in the economy. Just what's driving it?
I think you're absolutely right, and that's really the argument that you hear from the White House and from the Federal Reserve. Jerome Powell, the Federal Reserve Chair, makes this argument that these inflation worries are, likes to use the word transient. That's one of those good SAT words from high school days. But that is going to be short-lived. That there is this influx of cash from these stimulus payments that many people received in the last few months, and also pent-up demand. A lot of people have been working from home, haven't been out spending as much, so their savings accounts have grown a lot in the last year, and people are now ready to go out and spend more money. And so, yeah, you would expect that there would be these rising prices, but their argument is it's not a repeat of the 70s. This is just a short-term phenomenon. We will see it for a few months, like this summer. You know, if you're trying to go on vacation, we might see higher gas prices, higher hotel prices, these sorts of things, but that it'll eventually sort itself out by, say, this time next year. And that's why they're not trying to intervene to really overcorrect for this, because they don't see it as truly a fundamental problem, the termite problem. They see it more as like, okay, you got a couple flies in your house and you'll kill them or they'll die and, you know, you can move on, as opposed to a true pest problem.
Heather, when Joe Biden ran for president, I mean, he made no secret of going to tax those who had incomes over $400,000. Now, to pay for these plans, he's talking about those increases, those tax increases on those who are making over $400,000, but also significant tax increases on corporations, going from 21% to 28%. So will those tax increases, oh, and you also mentioned capital gains, but will those tax increases pay for this plan or plans?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question. So I would answer it this way. If all of those tax increases went into effect, it would almost pay for this plan. It gets pretty close. And there's some weird, wonky stuff in Washington where they like to look at how things pay over a 10-year period, to the costs and the revenues balance. It doesn't quite balance over 10 years, but it does balance over 15 years. So it's a little hand-wavy on the math, but they are certainly making more of an effort than, say, the last couple of administrations, both Republican and Democrat, to try to actually come close to paying for what they're talking about here. Of course, this means that these tax increases have to go into effect. Already in Congress, you can see, even on the Democratic side, some hesitancy to enact certainly all of these increases. I would just say really quickly on the tax things, and we can go into more detail if you'd like, or callers would like, on certain ones. On the corporate tax, remember that it used to be, you know, we went from, in the Trump era, 35% down to 21%. So the biggest corporate tax cut/ in history, in U.S. history. So the proposal is kind of to take it up to 28%. Honestly, when I talk to business leaders and business lobbyists in D.C., if it went to 25% tomorrow, nobody would bat an eye. So they'll probably end up somewhere between 25 and 28. That's the real debate. And there is a belief that that raising that corporate tax rate a little bit is probably not going to be detrimental. The economy, certainly big business having a great year, can generally absorb that tax increase. And frankly, a lot of CEOs will tell you off the record that they never thought it would get as low as 21% under the Trump administration or any administration. It's a little bit dicier on, you know, raising the capital gains tax. So this would only apply to people who make $1 million or more a year. So we are talking about not just the top 1%, but even smaller than that, really the sort of top 0.3% of Americans who would face this, but it is a doubling of the capital gains tax. And why does that matter? You know, that's a really big increase. And of course, capital gains, this is the money that the Bill Gateses of the world and others, and Warren Buffett's, that they're investing in, you know, in new products, in new companies, in new ideas. And so that's where your textbook 101, you know, if you took an economics course in college or in high school, you would see that raising a tax that much, you know, can dissuade investment. So I think there's going to be some negotiation around that rate.
We'll talk more about that in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program is Heather Long, economics correspondent at the Washington Post, and of course, well known here in central Pennsylvania as former deputy editor and columnist at the Patriot News in Harrisburg. We're talking about President Joe Biden's two big plans, the American Family Plan and the American Jobs Plan, infrastructure and care acts that we outlined last week. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Heather, I just want to follow up on something you mentioned right before the break, where you talked about the capital gains and money that is reinvested. That has been one of the criticisms of this plan, is that it could slow down reinvestment. It could slow down some of the hiring that that employers would make. It's hard to look into a crystal ball and know for sure, but what are you hearing from both sides on that?
Yeah, it's a great question, and certainly one of the biggest debates since the president keeps pitching this as a jobs plan. Here's where it gets a little tricky, is I think most models would tell you that these tax increases would have somewhat of a harm to the economy. So in traditional economic theory, it would decrease our growth, and it would decrease investment, and it would decrease jobs. But on the flip side, we are investing so much government cash that the question is, does that compensate for what the losses? Does it do more? And most models are actually saying that it would be a net job creator and a net gain for the economy, even with the tax increases. Because the big thing here with the second part of the plan, the family's plan, is having paid parental leave, having universal preschool, so 3 and 4 year olds going to some sort of preschool, pre-K program, could dramatically lift the number of women who are working and who are working full time than what we have historically seen in the United States economy. We actually lag behind many other, not just European countries, but also Canada and Japan for the number of women that we have working in our economy. So that's where the big gains could potentially come from, not to mention some dads as well. I don't want to exclude them, but the real big push for economists is to believe that these infrastructure investments would help, and these getting women back to work would overcompensate for the tax increases. That's a debate, and it will be a long debate this summer, but that's what I'm hearing.
Well, everything is going to be debated, that's for sure. But okay, just what you said, and I said earlier about how this is so interrelated. Just last week we had preliminary census figures that were released that found that the U.S. population, that growth has leveled off, and that our population is just not growing that fast. So the Biden plan, as you just said, counts on many women in particular getting back into the workforce. But you also have talked to economists who said that that's just not going to be enough. I mean, that we still need a bigger workforce. And then when you talk about interrelated issues, this economist pointed out that you would need a bigger immigration flow, right?
That's 100% right. And that's been true for a while and feels even more true now that we have those latest census numbers. And this is a really hard part for the Biden administration. They say they after they get through this infrastructure and this family care plan, they would like to turn to immigration reform. But this, good luck with that. Unfortunately, that seems unlikely that they would be able to do that. But so I don't know if they'll tackle that, you know, potentially the next president or in a second term, but immigration reform is very much needed for the economy and certainly needed for the country, whatever direction we ultimately choose to go on that. But I don't see it getting done anytime soon. And it's a huge, I mean, honestly, if you look at, we just did a big poll at the Washington Post and with ABC News and looking at Biden's first 100 days and how the country views him, he gets very high marks for handling the pandemic, fairly high marks for handling the economy, similar, a little bit higher to even Trump's marks and his early presidency. But the one area where Biden is really getting hit is on immigration and border issues, and probably rightfully so.
And there probably are people inside even the administration that would like to separate the two issues. But if it becomes an economic issue, it's going to have to be dealt with. Let's take a phone call from Mike in Camp Hill. Mike, you're on the air.
It's a great program, Scott. And Heather, I mean, you're fabulous. I really admire what you're saying. But I have a question. You have not, Scott, neither one of you has mentioned required minimum distributions, which affect people like my wife and myself. Once you reach age 70 and a half or whatever it is today, it was 70 and a half when we turned 70 and a half. People have to remove money from savings that we don't necessarily want to remove from the stock market. Regardless the size of that amount, which in my case isn't much, the question recurs, how does this intend to treat RMD, required minimum distribution? Is that part of what goes from 21% top rate to 28, or is it, as I think it is, higher than that now, and therefore it's going to be even higher than that now? Do you know the answer to that question? It seems like it punishes RMD, required minimum distributions.
Heather, do you know anything about that?
Yeah, that's a good question. My understanding, and I will say that I'm obviously not a tax counsel or a tax lawyer, but this should not impact the RMD. So unless you are earning over $400,000 a year, so this will not change the income taxes, and RMD is taxed at the income tax rate for individuals. So if you and your wife, I guess, if you're filing married jointly, were to get more than $400,000 out per year, then this would subject you to a higher tax rate. It's not at the 28% tax rate, but at the top rate for individuals who are making $400,000 or more a year would go up slightly under this plan. So that's how it would potentially impact. But if you earn less than that per year that's coming out, it would not change the tax rate.
Hey, Mike, thank you very much for your call. Okay, one of the things we're hearing a lot about, and I'll be honest with you, I don't know. I mean, because, you know, when there's so much information out there, you don't know what's accurate, what's not. And this has to do with people who are collecting unemployment and deciding not to go back to work because they're making more on unemployment than they would be if they went back to work. Heather, is this a real issue, and will it continue to be an issue?
It's definitely an issue right now, because those extra unemployment, so if you're unemployed, not only do you get the whatever amount you would normally get, and the average is around $300, it depends, you know, where you are in the country. I think PA is around $300 average per week. On top of that, the federal government is giving people another $300 a week. So that's $600 a week that somebody on unemployment is making, and they would be eligible, if they remain unemployed, to make that through the end of the summer, basically through Labor Day weekend. So, and then on top of that, many of people who are low and moderate income, of course, receive those $1,400 stimulus payments in March or April, and the $600 one in kind of just after the holidays. So it is a big cash infusion to people right now. And certainly if for people who are might normally work at a job that pays $10 an hour, $11 an hour, $12 an hour, yeah, they can earn about as much on unemployment right now. And you are certainly hearing that and seeing that in the restaurant industry. I just got back from Alaska, and there were obviously a huge tourism destination there. A lot of people saying it was hard to find seasonal workers for tourism jobs this summer to work those $12 or less an hour jobs, or in like canning factories, you know, to actually can and gut fish. So these jobs that are maybe not as a little bit harder, a little bit smellier, a little bit muckier. So the question, though, is do these plans that Biden is proposing, medium and long term, would they dissuade people from working? The argument there is no, they would not, because these payments are not continuing forever. So the unemployment money that's very generous would be over by Labor Day.
Well, then that brings up the argument of increasing the minimum wage to $15 an hour. You know, in normal times, that would be dealt with on its own and would still be a big issue, a big debate in Congress or on the state level. But as part of this program or part of these proposals, it's just one of a lot of different things to talk about. So, I mean, actually, quite frankly, I mean, we hear more about it on the state level than we do on the federal level. But how much of a part will that be in the debate, the $15 minimum wage? How much of a part will that play in this debate over these proposals?
Yeah, that's a great question, Scott. So just to remind people, it is not part of this plan to go to 15 for all around, you know, for the country. What is part of this plan is for certain workers, for instance, in the pre-K field. So the preschool workers and elder care workers, so home health aides who are caring for elderly. It proposes $15 an hour for these types of workers, with the goal of recruiting more people to work in these industries and recruiting, you know, well-paid and well-qualified people to teach our kids and to care for elderly relatives. So it's not a $15 minimum wage across the country. Now, President Biden has said he would like to do that, but it's interesting he doesn't actually put it into these plans yet. I think I'll just say really quickly on the minimum wage, I think it's important to remember that, you know, for instance, in PA, I believe it's still $7.25 an hour.
It is.
So, and hasn't changed since, you know, 2009. I think most people, if you talk to business executives and, you know, small or large, a lot of people could accept right now, tomorrow, I think Congress would vote on an $11 or $12 an hour minimum wage for the country, and it could probably pass fairly easily with bipartisan support. Many of big companies are already, the Amazons and Targets and Walmarts of the world, are already paying that wage or higher as a starting. Where it gets tricky is, do you go all the way to 15? And that's where there's still heavy debate. You know, would it cause more automation? Would it cause, when you go into a restaurant, not to have as many waiters and waitresses, and instead you're just going to be hitting the touchscreen? And that's a real debate. I mean, I honestly think that there are arguments on both sides about 15.
We have an email from Sarah who says, the era of smaller government has seen its day. Government is to protect and provide services for the citizenry. We are still reaping the benefits of the CCC after 90 years. The Biden administration is right to go bold. Infrastructure is different in the modern world. We need services like broadband, as well as bridges, health care, as well as national defense, early education programs, and environmental conservation. Heather, you did talk to people who said that, and I'm going to backtrack for just a moment, and this kind of sums it up in that there are those who are asking whether Joe Biden is a transitional president, much like Franklin Roosevelt during the Great Depression, that this is the biggest proposal since then. And, you know, as Sarah says, that, you know, the era of small government is over. It appears as though Americans, especially younger Americans, are okay with that.
Yeah, I think you just hit it on the head. That is what is so interesting. And we just saw this in the Washington Post poll we put out, and I've written about it in my articles. There is a huge generational divide on this issue. People 40 and under and non-white Americans, so Hispanic and Black Americans, overwhelmingly support a larger government role. They support plans like what Biden is proposing. Folks who are older over 40 and who tend to be white, they tend to still support smaller government with fewer services. So there is a big pivot going on, and Biden is trying to pitch this really as a plan for the future and future generations. The other interesting thing we saw in the poll is support for smaller government, sort of the Reagan-esque mantra, was at its lowest level since 1984. It's really the first time that we've seen in our polling that support for small government fell under 50%. So pretty notable shift going on, even from just a few years ago, let alone from the perceptions of the 80s and the 90s. So I think here's how I sum it up. Biden has the potential to be FDR-like and New Deal-like and taking the country in a new direction. But there's a big but there. And that but is he has to pass this. He has to pass both of these proposals, which is going to be a very heavy lift, even with his own party. And as we've been talking about, and you're going to talk more about in the second segment, he has to, there cannot be these huge negative unintended consequences like rising inflation coming from these plans.
So to sum it up, Heather, what you've been talking about, during our conversation here and what you just said, it sounds as if the president is making a huge gamble that what he's proposing here is going to lead the country forward. And I look at this 10-15 year plan. I mean, a lot can happen in 10 to 15 years, but is this a big gamble?
I think it is. The White House argues that the benefits would outweigh the costs. And I do think, in the United States, we have to think long and hard that the new world is competing against China and other parts of the world. And, keeping the status quo how it is also a dangerous gamble. So what risks do we want to take right now? What investments do we want to make? That is the debate we are having right now in this country.
Heather Long, always great to talk with you. Heather Long is an economics correspondent with The Washington Post. Of course, she was a senior economics reporter at CNN, a columnist, deputy editor at The Patriot News here in Harrisburg. Heather, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, one of our segments is going to deal with that slow growth of the population here in Pennsylvania and across the country, but especially here in Pennsylvania. That's part of tomorrow's program, so be sure to tune in. Price inflation, as you just heard, with a few exceptions now and then, has not been an issue for the American consumer or the U.S. economy as a whole for at least the past decade. Yeah, prices will go up from time to time on some items, but for the most part, they've been stable. That is, until recently, the prices of houses have soared over the past few months. Gasoline cost more. Prices on some items at the grocery store have gone up. So is inflation in the nation's future? Joining us now is Dr. Maria Ivanova Reyes, assistant professor and economist at Gettysburg College. So, Dr. Reyes, home prices up, lumber way up, gasoline up, some grocery items like meat and essentials like toilet paper up. Are we seeing a return of inflation?
Good morning, Scott. So what I will say is that no. What we are seeing is fluctuations in prices of very volatile items, like food prices, as you mentioned, and energy prices, and also the housing market, due to the effects of the pandemic. So what we are seeing right now is the disruption that has been coming for several months right now, and that we have not been able to cope well with still, because the supply chain of food distribution are still distorted because of the pandemic. Like, costs of firms have increased. Firms have had to switch to improve their health standards and also switch to more technology-based provision that has lower contact. And all of this has increased their costs. So they're passing their costs to consumers. Like, how this is going to adjust in the next coming months will depend on how firms adjust their long-term costs. What we see in terms of the Federal Reserve monetary policy is that they look at long-term inflation. So in terms of long-term inflation, we are still seeing that the target is where we want it to be, slightly above 2% inflation for personal consumption expenditure index. However, in the upcoming 2-3 months, we are still going to be seeing these short-term fluctuations in food prices, energy prices, because also the supply of oil dropped during the pandemic, and producers of oil have not been able to keep up. And in terms of housing, we still are going to see disruptions because we have a segment of the population that has not been that affected by the pandemic and that have reduced their consumption of luxury items because of the social isolation. And now they have a lot of cash. So they have increased their demand for houses with a supply that has not been able to keep up. So with low mortgages and these type of conditions, we have another element of inequality of the pandemic in which housing prices are also seeing a hike.
There's a lot you just explained, and I want to touch on much of what you just talked about. I want to tell our listeners that if you have a question or a comment for Dr. Reyes, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Reyes, I don't know whether you heard our last segment with Heather Long of the Washington Post or not, but we were talking about what's being proposed by the Biden administration. And, you know, there are a couple things that are at play here. You know, $4 trillion in spending. Much of it will be going to the American people. Many economists, and I don't know about yourself, but I'll ask a little bit later, are expecting, you know, jobs to pick up, hiring to pick up, that the economy will be making a comeback even without that money coming from Washington. The big concern is that the economy will be overheated. In other words, there'll be so much cash out there that inflation will go higher than that 2 or 2.5% that in which it is now. How much of a potential danger is that?
Okay, so generally speaking, the problem that we have had in industrialized economies, including the United States during the past, let's say, 10 years, is extremely low inflation. So inflation that has not reached the target from below. The target for the United States core inflation, which excludes items that fluctuate a lot, such as food and energy, is 2%. And we have not successfully been hitting that. Did you have a question, Scott? Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Okay. So we have not been successfully hitting that target. For the first time, we're seeing that we are approaching that target. The latest numbers of core personal consumption expenditure index inflation places at 1.8%. So we are approaching it. But what happens is that the Federal Reserve needs to balance not only reaching the target of 2% before they try to accommodate any overheating in the economy, but also they need to balance long-term goals on inflation. The Fed cannot be responding to short-term fluctuations. A short-term fluctuation is all of these very strong hikes in food prices, energy, and housing, and any potential hikes because of a big impulse of fiscal investment and fiscal expenditures in the economy, like what is being discussed with the Biden plan. So if any of those items generate long-term inflationary pressures, then the Fed will act. And their models are very consistent. They are constantly monitoring the developments of inflation and constantly thinking about adjusting their monetary policy stance to avoid any overheating in the economy. As of now, the latest projections of inflationary expectations from the Fed and the Survey of Professional Forecasters places us with a long-term inflation no more than 2.20%. How in the 10-year horizon. So how accurate is this? Of course, depends on many, many aspects of the economy. Maybe we evolve into being an economy that grows at a faster pace and is consistent with having a sustainable inflation a little bit above 2.20%. But that's not the ideal for the United States. The ideal is that we stay consistently close to 2%. And because of what I mentioned before, of the problem of having so low inflation in the past, the Fed is trying to be a little bit more relaxed in terms of what is the inflation that we have. So they're going to try to be less accommodative to any small fluctuations above 2%. So let's say if the core inflation that I'm referring to, that one that excludes the very volatile items, stays slightly above 2% for a couple of months, the Fed may not act. I cannot tell you with assurance that they won't increase the interest rate to contain any overheating in the economy. But the thing is that unemployment as of the latest numbers is at 6%. And we are seeing a long-term target of unemployment that is consistent with a balanced economy of 4%. So we are not there yet. So it will be talking about an overheating economy means that we are growing really fast, generating many jobs, and this is being the trigger of inflation. What we are seeing right now is that we are growing at a moderate rate, a rate that is consistent with recovery from the pandemic, but we are still not overheating the economy from production, from extra consumption and spending in the economy. So we are still catching up. And we see this because unemployment has not picked up.
You know, I'm always curious about the Federal Reserve's role in this. I mean, so often we hear, and you just mentioned about interest rates. And interest rates, I mean, the prime rate is still very, very low. Mortgage rates, obviously, are very low. But what tools does the federal government, or excuse me, the Federal Reserve have to control inflation other than interest rates?
Well, they have been doing unconventional monetary policy since we faced the global financial crisis. And this unconventional monetary policy has to do with increasing credit to corporations and credit to financial institutions that they typically don't increase credit to. And they do this by purchasing debt from these institutions in a temporary basis. So basically, they alter the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve, which is a process called quantitative easing. And they just take chances in purchasing this debt that other institutions don't tend to do during economic crisis. So I'm talking about the side of stimulating the economy. When it has to do with constraining any overheating in the economy, all these operations will be reverted. So in addition to increasing interest rates, they will have a reversion of this. And we saw that after the global financial crisis.
You know, one thing, and I don't know whether this is something that you would teach in your economy classes, but, yes. You know, this is kind of anecdotal. that when we talk about inflation, like we are talking about it on this program today, that sometimes it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, that when you talk about it, it happens. I mean, yep. How does that happen? And I mean, is that a real potential danger here?
Well, you know, like for a country like the United States, the benchmark for that danger of accelerating inflation, it's low relative to what will happen in developing countries, in middle-income countries. So at certain levels of inflationary pressures, maybe people will start panicking. I don't think we are there because we don't see the prices of every single item going up. So there are many items in our consumption, in our daily consumption, that are being relatively stable. What we are seeing is some key food items and energy prices and housing prices picking up. So, like, if you have panic in an economy, some vendors will translate their fear to increasing prices and accelerating prices, and this will create panic inflation and a bubble in prices. I think with just a few items of our daily consumption having this volatile reaction right now, we will not be seeing this. Now, what we need, even though I'm mentioning that it's just a few items and they respond to market fluctuations at the domestic and also at the global level, because we are also seeing global price indices skyrocketing right now because of these same pandemic effects. We need to have a central bank that anchors expectations, that is communicative, and also an authority that is communicative and informs the people that we are not controlling inflation, because these are temporary effects. And that's what they are. Mm. And I know it's problematic for people to see, because the lowest income quintiles in the US population are the ones who suffer the most from the increasing food prices. And that's a problem. So we have like a macro type of policy in which we want the economy to grow. And then we have micro problems when we are trying to let this economy grow naturally. We are not doing anything right now in terms of monetary policy. We're doing a lot of active fiscal policy to stimulate the cycle, but not that active in terms of the monetary front. But we have effects at the micro level because of fluctuations due to the pandemic. And these effects affect the most vulnerable the most. Mm. So we need other type of policies to address those problems.
Well, yeah, and let's face it, American consumers very often focus on those things like gasoline. I mean, it always amazes me, and I'm guilty of it myself, that price of a gallon of gasoline goes up 10 cents. I'm like, oh, my God, what's going on here? When meat is up 6-7%, toilet paper's costing more, things that we deal with every day when we see the prices going up, many of us assume that, oh, inflation is getting out of hand when we see those daily items, the prices going up. Is there any one area of inflation, maybe a product, maybe a service, that does concern you that will be long term?
That will be long term increase.
Yeah.
Well, in general, I think generally speaking, in the long term, in the medium term, companies are going to continue having rising costs. So until we are done with the pandemic, we're going to see entire year 2021, potentially a year 2022, in which health controls in type of industrial settings in which you need many workers assembling together in a plant and close to each other to guarantee that there is no contagion, the companies are going to continue with increasing cost of production because they need to have very strict health standards. Or alternatively, they will have to switch to other type of practices that are less labor intensive and are very costly for the companies to establish. At the same time, those practices are conducive to more unemployment. So we are still going to see this type of cost towards 2022, translating into higher costs of food prices and food distribution.
Hmm. One of the products that has really seen an increase right now is the cost of lumber. What's driving that, and will the prices come down?
Well, so lumber is, as many other global commodities, like something that is very volatile. I don't know the specifics of the market for lumber and why it fluctuates, but if you look at historical prices of commodities, there are periods in which they skyrocket. One explanation of why some commodities are increasing a lot in prices right now is because, and I don't know if this is the case for lumber, but it's because production stagnated last summer, last spring and last summer. And then as it picks up, it takes time for it to picking up and to match up the higher demand of an active economy. So those are type of the reasons why you have those increases. Well, also, transportation costs increase because energy prices have increased. Also, as a result of oil producers worldwide contracting production last year when the global economy was depressed.
Dr. Maria Ivanova Reyes, assistant professor and economist at Gettysburg College. Interesting. Thank you very much for your insights today.
Hey, thank you very much for having me. Have a great day.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.